Welcome back to the program. Many of us would like to think that we live in a post-racial society. And while we may be post-racial when it comes simply to skin color, as the election and re-election of Barack Obama bears out, we are not when it comes to racial character and the perception and expectation of racial stereotypes. For today, even younger generations seem inculcated with certain racial ideas for which their experience and encounters either run consistent with or counter to those racial perceptions. Sometimes they even seem as if they're hardwired into us. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Devin Carbato. He is the Associate Dean at the UCLA School of Law and Professor of Law and African American Studies, and it is my pleasure to welcome Devin Carbato here to talk about his book, Acting White, Rethinking Race in Post-Racial America. Devin Carbato, thanks so much for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here. First of all, explain what you mean by racial character.
So the basic point of the book is to suggest that the standard way in which we think about racial discrimination, particularly in the context of law, is somewhat limited. And the best way to understand what we mean by that is to quickly analogize to gender. So when we think about sex discrimination, we understand that it might occur when, for example, an institution prefers men over women. But we also understand that sex discrimination can occur when an institution prefers feminine women over masculine women or masculine women over feminine women. So we understand that there's a performative or a character dimension to how we think about gender, that institution might prefer members of the same group over other members of that group. We're simply saying that there's a similar dynamic at play with race, so that when we think about race, we're not simply looking at a person's skin color. We're looking at aspects of that person's identity that might loosely be referred to as character. So accent, speech, demeanor, where a person lives, their associations, all of these are racial signifiers just as skin color is a racial signifier, and they can operate as a basis upon which people make racial judgments.
To what extent is that wrapped up in our perceptions of class in general? I mean, even as it relates to our perception of people that might be white or anything else for that matter?
I think it's absolutely fair to say that there's a class dimension of this, so that when we think about people who might be quote-unquote really black, we might be thinking about people who live in the inner city, for example. So I do think there's a connection between how we think about race and character and the role that class plays in it. One can also think about racial character in terms of ethnicity. The black community in the United States is a complicated community. There are people who are not born in the United States. There are people who don't necessarily trace their ancestry to American slavery in the United States. There are black Latinos. And so it's helpful to remember that blackness is not a monolithic identity. And so when you think about questions of race and character, class is a piece of it. Ethnicity is a piece of it. But there are other dimensions more generally that simply relate to whether or not some African Americans are perceived to be more racially comfortable to be around than others. In the same way that people say quite freely sometimes that some women are more comfortable to be around than others.
To what extent is authenticity a part of this? And when I say that, I want to jump on what you're saying in terms of what's comfortable and what isn't, and the degree to which an individual is or isn't comfortable with his or herself being a part of the equation as well.
I think authenticity plays a role in a number of different ways. So the first thing to say about that is in the book, we are clear that we do not think that there's some true way to act white or some true way to act black, that there's some authentic way to be white or authentic way to be black. We simply mean to say that people nevertheless perceive others in that way. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I think is that it is the case that we have views about what authenticity might look like. So African Americans might have the view that some people are authentically black and some people are not. Whites might have that view as well. So black actors, for example, sometimes complain that when they go out to audition for particular roles, the expectation is that they will ratchet up their performance of blackness, or they'll be told that you don't sound exactly black, and in order for our audiences to sort of understand you as black, you need to be sure to sort of speak with a particular accent or embody your blackness in a particular way. So expectations of authenticity, it seems to me, come from all over the place.
One of the points that you make is that really, instead of demonstrating that race doesn't matter, that much of this talk about post-racial America and the election of President Obama really shows that race matters, in fact, more than ever, or that racial character, in fact, matters so profoundly.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious to me that the discourse about post-racialism sort of emerges in the context of President Obama's ascendancy to the forefront of American politics in a couple of respects. You might remember that during his presidential run, there was an awful lot of conversation about racially constitutive voting, meaning what does the white working class vote think about Obama, or what are Latinos thinking, or what are African Americans thinking, or what are black women thinking, etc. And at the same time that we're looking very carefully at these very specific racial demographics, on the one hand, we're also saying that we're post-racial on the other. That's the first part. So that there's some disconnect between those two phenomena, it seems to me. The other thing, though, is that with Barack Obama, there were explicit discussions about whether he is acting white, acting black, not acting white enough. So with respect to his particular identity, this sort of character dimension of race, I think, was squarely on the table. And it was certainly the subject of late-night comedy. I'm not quite sure if you saw this Saturday Night Live clip. It was really quite funny. And the question the clip presents is, to what extent is America ready for a black president? And the answer was, well, it depends on his degrees of blackness or scales of soul. And certain factors moving up and down the scale. So the fact that he has an African name, Barack, moves him up the scales of blackness. But in high school, he went by Barry, moves him down the scales of blackness. He was raised by a single mother and a grandmother. That moves him up the scales of blackness. The fact that he was raised in Hawaii moves him down. So you get the idea.
Right.
So they're trying to suggest that the question of Barack Obama's ability to successfully run for president wasn't going to turn just on the fact that he might be perceived to be an African-American. It was going to turn on these other factors as well. And we can quarrel, of course, with whether these factors work in exactly the same way that this skit on Saturday Night Live suggests. But the point is that there are attributes of identity that we take into account when we think about people in terms of race that are not just about how people look in terms of their skin color.
Many of the divides with respect to these ideas of racial character come, it seems, more out of our popular culture than anything else.
Yeah, I do think popular culture plays a role in this, and perhaps is the place where we see these dynamics most saliently. But they're existing outside of that context as well. It's just that we don't necessarily name it as such because we tend to lock our understanding of discrimination onto a very narrow model. So it's not that the character or performative dimensions of race don't exist outside of pop culture. It's just that that is the context in which I think we're most comfortable taking these questions up.
In many ways, it's a kind of cultural prejudice that enters into the equation as opposed to a more racial prejudice, it seems.
Well, I think the line between culture and race is really difficult to articulate with clarity. I mean, if you think about it historically, the arguments about primitivism and culture of indigenous people or African people, I mean, those arguments about culture are already linked to arguments about race. If you think about the extent to which stereotypes about blacks being criminal or not working hard or welfare queens, I mean, all of those could be framed as cultural arguments, but they're fundamentally arguments about race. So it's really difficult, it seems to me, to figure figure out when you're talking about culture and when you're talking about race. The two are really interconnected and historically have been in ways that are quite hard to always disentangle.
Is one of the ways in which they can be separated the degree to which there is legal recourse to deal with issues of prejudice and discrimination?
Well, the question that that invites us to take up is, what do we mean by racial discrimination in the first instance? So again, if we go back to gender, we might be able to think about this more generally. One could say that the question of whether or not a woman is perceived to be masculine or feminine is not a sex discrimination question. It's a character question. It's a cultural question. It's a performative question. But courts have not understood sex discrimination in that way. So let me give you the classic case where this came up. So it's a woman who's up for partnership at an accounting firm. She's denied partnership, and the evidence revealed that the partner said, well, you know, if you talk more feminine, walk more feminine, wear makeup, get your hair styled, then maybe we'll promote you the next year. And the court says that's sex discrimination. The fact that you're not saying we won't hire any woman doesn't mean it's not sex discrimination, because you're presuming to tell women how to embody their agenda. And so one could easily frame that as a question of cultural norms around gender. One could easily say that that's not sex discrimination per se, but that's not the way courts think about it. Sensibly, courts have said that when you make institutional decisions based on the idea that women must be X, i.e. feminine, for example, that's problematic, and the law should have something to say about that. So we're saying that there's something like that going on with race as well. You can't simply say that it's culture disconnected from race, because it's linked up with racial stereotypes, it's linked up with expectations about how people should embody their identities in the workplace, and therefore we should be thinking about what role, if any, the law should play.
Isn't the key criteria the degree to which we have control over those outcomes? In other words, you can't change your identity from black to white or white to black. You can't change your gender. I mean, I suppose you can, but you can't change your gender from male to female, etc. But you can determine how you act and the nature of your character.
Well, I think your question invites its own answer, in the sense that we know now that technology is such that people can make more changes vis-a-vis their physical embodiment than historically was the case. So it, you know, people can bleach their skin. So what if an employer said, well, look, we want black people who are fair-skinned. You can go out there and buy bleaching cream and bleach your skin and make it fair. Would we think that's okay because there's a product out there that permits you, that enables you to bleach your skin? I think most people would say no. Even if we stipulated that you can do that without causing harm to your health, we would say that requiring a person to change their identity in that way is problematic. We can take that up another level. So should we require people who might speak with a quote-unquote black accent to change their accent because the employer thinks that that's too racially associative, that that means that they employee is going to be understood to be too black? Should we therefore require that person to get rid of that accent or be denied the opportunity to work at that institution? I think that the question of whether people can change who they are doesn't really answer the question of whether or not we should require them to do so. The fundamental question in the first instance is, do we think that these things are somehow connected to race in some way? And if we do, is it permissible for the employer to make judgments about how that person should relate to those aspects of their identity, whether it's their skin color, whether it's their accent, whether it's the people with whom they associate, whether it's their politics, whatever? Should the employer be able to say, if you want to work at this firm, you must, you know, bleach your skin, change your accent, dress a particular way, not identify with your race in a particular way? Is that something we're comfortable empowering employers to do? That's really the question.
Because so much of this area of character or racial character is tied up in culture and even in popular culture, as we've talked about, the norms are more fluid and more dynamic in terms of what is and isn't acceptable within the context of culture, because culture changes more quickly. To what extent is that part of the equation?
I think that's a huge part of the equation, and it presents some difficulties for law, quite frankly, because one can raise questions about the moment that law intervenes might be the moment that culture is changing. Mm-hmm. So precisely because culture is more dynamic, more fluid, law is more conservative and static to some extent, one worries about the extent to which law might be mobilized to deal some of the problems with some of the problems that we describe. So in some ways, we're raising consciousness about these questions and encouraging people to sort of think about race more expansively, but we don't have some easy fix. That is, that the law should rush in and try to fix all of these problems. We're not sure that that's the right way to go, but nor are we satisfied with the view that we should continue to think about race just in terms of phenotype. That seems to us to be incredibly outdated, given what we know about racial dynamics more generally.
Perhaps an example of what you're talking about can be seen right now in the whole gay marriage issue, in terms of the way cultural norms are shifting so dramatically, even while the law is trying to play catch-up.
I think gay marriage is an apt analogy in multiple ways, because it does reveal the extent to which there is a lag between culture and law and the importance of pushing law to catch up. And it's helpful in that we don't think of sexual orientation just as a sort of static or status identity. In that context, too, we understand that, you know, gays and lesbians are treated differently depending on whether or not they're perceived to be acting straight or not acting straight. So even in the context of sexual orientation, or perhaps especially in that context, there's a recognition that a lesbian or a gay person's vulnerability to discrimination doesn't just turn on whether we perceive them to be gay. It also turns on how gay or lesbian we perceive them to be. And if you notice that the marriage equality debate and the people who are at the front of that movement are people who appear to be just like heterosexuals in terms of their normative relationships. I mean, they look like, sound like, etc., precisely because that kind of gay and lesbian person is the one who's likely to persuade Americans that, you know, gay and lesbian people are conventional just like everyone else. But even with respect to that movement, it seems to me, there's an effort to kind of present the right kind of gay and lesbian so that America is persuaded that marriage equality should not be a controversial thing at all. Extending this particular right is extending it to people just like everyone else, which is to say heterosexual.
So much of it is tied up, to come back to what we were talking about early on, so much of it is tied up in these stereotypes, and the racial stereotypes have such deep and long roots that it makes it so much more complicated in some ways. I mean, going all the way back to the Clark's experiments with dolls, for example.
Yeah, I mean, stereotypes, you're right, play a really crucial role. And as you might know, social psychologists of the past couple of decades have been trying to find ways to make us more mindful of the extent to which we have internalized negative stereotypes about race. So concretely, there are now studies on implicit biases, which suggest that even though we've come a long way with respect to race, and it's really important to point that out, I mean, America has come a long way with respect to race, and important racial progress has been made. There is still important work to be done. And so people now, very few people now would say, you know, hey, I'm a racist, or I have negative views about, you know, fill in the blank non-white group. You don't see that as often as one did historically. But on the other hand, people still have implicit biases that these social psychologists are able to capture in deep and profound ways. And so figuring out what to do with that is really hard. And it's certainly hard as a matter of law, but it's also hard just as a matter of social practice and getting people to sort of understand that their everyday decisions might be motivated by these implicit biases which they carry in their heads. but not necessarily in their heart as such.
How much of this is shaped today by our diversity of experience? And I mean, it used to be that people lived in a particular community for long periods of time. The people they had came in contact with were more limited. The nature of travel, of communications today is such that there's a much greater diversity that people come in contact with. To what extent is that shaping this debate?
I think it's shaping a debate in some ways and not in others. So notwithstanding that, I think there is far more mobility than historically was the case. It's also fair to say that certainly if one looks at major urban settings, where people live remains largely segregated. So if you think about students who end up in school, in universities, for example, most of them have had racially exclusive experience, and that college becomes the site for the possibility for interracial contact. And even in cities like Los Angeles or New York or et cetera, which on the one hand are very vibrant and culturally and racially diverse, they still have a compartmentalized dimension to them so that people navigate these cities in racially exclusive or specific ways. So there is both a vibrant diversity on the one hand and continued isolation or racial exclusivity on the other. And we haven't really found a way to sort of talk about that yet, but these two things, I think, are existing at precisely the same time.
UCLA Law Professor Devin Carbato, his book is Acting White, Rethinking Race in Post-Racial America. Devin, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Not at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.